On the programme Green Crow and Silver Tassie, Sean O'Casey remembered.
A sour-souled cleric passing near saw lovers by a rowan tree. He cursed its branches, berries bloom through time and through eternity.
Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. John Kavanagh there from the album The Green Crow Caws, a musical celebration of the works of Sean O'Casey. Tonight, we remember O'Casey 50 years after his death. We'll hear rare recordings of the playwright talking about Dublin music of his youth, hear more of those remarkable, vivid arrangements of his words and songs from the Green Crow album, visit an exhibition of Rebel Playwright with a Cause at Farmley House in Dublin, and speak to the Guardian theatre critic Michael Billington about O'Casey's work as a new production of The Silver Tassie opens at the National Theatre in London. First, though, one person who's particularly pleased about that production, the playwright's daughter, Siobhan O'Casey, who was in Ireland recently. She has long honoured and carried the spirit of her father's work and words. She herself a significant figure in theatre, having trained as a set designer and also worked as actress and director, bringing several productions of her father's plays to the stage over the years and for years running the O'Casey Theatre Company in the US. I met her recently in Dublin and she told me about her father's love of song and music. Was she very aware of this when she was growing up?
Well, I was in the sense that he sang a lot and he sang and he quoted a lot of Shakespeare, and that was part of his being, if you like. And he was always, you know, I wouldn't say, I mean, then my brother eventually got a gramophone and he would go and sit and listen to all his jazz records and then also, you know, some of the Messiah and all the other music that we had to sort of teach him a little bit about classical music. My brothers did, because he used to come in when we were listening and talk and we'd go, shh. But he loved it. And we used to do opera at school and I was Count de Luna in, the Il Troubadore, and it's Home to Our Mountains. So I was singing Home to Our Mountains and he said, oh, you know, that's in my play. And sang it with me.
So you sing?
Oh, not really, no. But I did when I was 8.
Did you ever sing any of his songs, of Sean's songs?
Well, not, yeah, I mean, I know a few, you know, but I didn't like... I never sort of stood up and sang. We didn't do that as a family.
And did he talk at all about the source of the songs, you know, the source of melody and remembered songs and music, you know, that he carried from Dublin and from his childhood?
He didn't really talk about it, but it's so obvious that it was in his whole being, song and love of poetry and music and birds and, you know, all the things that go with sound. And it's so obvious in his plays that the song is often integral to the play, isn't it? Like Red Roses for Me and The Silver Tassie. And then even in Juno where, you know, it is there. I don't have a play without a little bit of a dance and a song in a way. And then, of course, his other great play is Within the Gates, which is full of song and music and
which isn't done nearly often enough.
I don't think it's ever been done since America with Lillian Gish.
Has it never been done since?
I don't think so, not to my knowledge. It's a huge undertaking, but it, you know, I think now it could be almost done, you know, it's got so much music and it's so beautiful and a lot of poetry. It's quite a difficult piece to do, but the ending is so incredible.
Of course, one project where the music worked so well was John Kavanagh's marvellous record.
With Paul Brady, yes.
The Green Crow Caws.
Sean Murphy got that going together, yes. He was the one that instigated that.
I think it's probably over 30 years ago now. And what was so striking then and what remains so striking is the power and truth and tenderness of so many of those songs and the beautiful lament for Thomas Ashe.
Yes. Yeah. That's so sad. What a sad moment in history that was. But he was, I think, the humour also that's in them is great.
It's absolutely brimming with humour.
Yes.
And that must have been such a big part of him, because that comes across so strongly.
Absolutely. He was incredibly funny. And he and Eileen both had a great sense of humour. Eileen said that's the one thing that stuck them together, was their great sense of humour. It got them out of all sorts of difficulties.
I'm sure they needed it at times.
Yes.
Do you have a favourite, I mean, maybe that's impossible, you know, a favourite song or maybe a few songs of his that you like to listen to or that you remember with particular affection?
Well, I do love the song, the last song in the Janis song in Within the Gates is an absolutely beautiful song, which isn't heard at all, really. Well, it wasn't on the Paul Brady one. And otherwise, you know, it's not really. It was, you know, of course, the Nora song is very, very beautiful. And Red Roses for Me. Those are the two. And I love, you know, the ones, all the ones really in Red Roses, the ones that, you know, the Brennan on the Moor sings and everything.
What kind of singing voice did your father have?
Well, when he was young, it was evidently a very good baritone voice, and I bet it was, because sometimes when he was what you might call in good voice, you could hear what it would have been. But, you know, he was a smoker, and he inhaled a pipe, so it was a lot of that going on.
And later...
Later, yes. I mean, but he did sing to me to put me to sleep and stuff, you know, songs. And my mum did too. She had a lovely voice, contralto, really beautiful voice. So I was full of song. We all were.
You couldn't miss the
music.
And of course, Sean had played the Ilan pipes, hadn't he? And was very involved in the Lawrence O'Toole pipe band.
Well, with the big pipes he played.
Yes.
And but his brother couldn't put up with the sound, so he pierced the bag and that was it.
He pierced the bag?
It's in the autobiographies.
It is, I've forgotten that. Yeah. It's quite a shocking act, though. Not the first time, though, I think such a thing had been done. I think then, did your mother record Sean speaking about song and music?
Yes.
Quite late on.
Well, it was Sean, really. Well, the idea was he... At the end of his life, the last few years, I mean, I suppose you're talking 4 or 5 years of his life, he was, in fact, clinically blind. So that meant it put a terrible strain on the one eye to read and it would throb. So he really could only read for a certain length of time. And it was literally with the page right up to the eye. So he was following it letter by letter almost. And so Bernard Miles, actually, who ran the Mermaid Theatre, suggested that he should record some stuff, you know, record his work, write like that. And Sean thought, well, I can't do that, but I tell you what I would love to do is go through all the songs that I, you know, knew all my life and record them and talk around them. And so Bernard Miles gave them this little Grundig recorder. And they used to do that. They used to sit of an evening and go through it. And Eileen says it describes him the first time as, you know, dressing up and standing up. And she said, Sean, you don't have to do that. You can just sit down and relax. No, they're lovely little recordings.
Wonderful sound memory to have.
In my very young days, Dublin could be called really a city of song. You hadn't very far to go from where you happened to live before you met somebody singing a song in the street, or if it were at night time, you might pause beside a well-lighted and nicely curtained window and hear a voice coming out, tenor or baritone, singing a song to the accompaniment of a piano. Those were in the most respectable houses, such as, for instance, the one that I quote in I Knock at the Door. It went like this. On the banks of the Clyde stood a lad and his lassie. The lad's name was Georgie, the lassie's was Jane. She flung her arms around him and cry, do not leave me. For Georgie was going to fight for his queen.
This year not only marks the 50th anniversary of your father's death, it also marks the centenary of the start of the First World War. And The Silver Tassie, of course, one of the great plays about that war and about all war. Mm. And interestingly, seen by some as part of almost of a quartet of Dublin plays, you know, with Juno, Shadow of a Gunman and Plough the Stars, more so than is seen again by others as a later, more experimental, standalone play. Do you read the play in that way? And do you know if Sean saw it as linked, strongly linked to the others?
Well, obviously it was linked, with his technique, if you like, with his way of writing, because it was getting, you could see it even from Shadow to Juno. I mean, Juno's not realistic. None of them are realistic. And then, of course, Plough opens up and is hugely more epic and bigger. And then he went that bit further. It's an obvious sequence, isn't it, in writing? So, and developing your skill. And yes, I mean, I suppose he never would have thought of linking plays together. He never would have called them the Irish Trilogy, for instance. But they are really historical, about history, aren't they? And I do think if you are going to say that, then obviously the Tassie is part of that history, particularly as it is, you know, from an Irish viewpoint. And the Irish people going to the war, and then it opens up to be a universal comment on the tragedy and the, you know, the destruction and the stupidity of war, really.
And of course, Silver Tassie being produced at the National Theatre in London later this year. And I'm sure you're very glad to see that play being done again, and especially in this year, for both those reasons.
I'm delighted. I can't wait to see it. I love the sets and have great faith in, you know, Howard Davies as a director. And I think the young man playing Harry, who is, you know, should be brilliant, Ronan Raftery. He was Johnny in the Juno. And I really, really look forward to it very much. And seeing it on a large, you know, fairly large stage, the Littleton, which has huge depth, and they're going to use that in the design. So it will open up, and I think it should be very... I'm always been interested in design, so it's something that I started off doing. I studied design, so you know, for me, that's fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Okay, I think the National had planned to do Silver Tassie before.
Yes, about when my mother was still alive. Howard Davies has wanted to do it for years. He loves the play, and it was about to be done. As far as I know, they'd paid the advance, and then it suddenly stopped when Richard Eyre was there. I don't think he wanted it. It was a great blow to my mum, because I think she really wanted it. For her, it was a play she loved, because she'd seen the original production, you know, that Cochrane had put on with Charles Laughton and Augustus John's middle set and Evan Walters' other set, and the music by Martin Shaw, who was, you know, a colleague of Gordon Craig. He worked with Gordon Craig. So the sound and music must have been amazing. And it was a production they talked about a lot in home. You know, I mean, home was that production of the Tassie was often brought up, and also the production in America of Within the Gates with Lillian Gish as the young whore. And the pictures of that are beautiful. It looks like it was really good.
I'm sure you must wish at times that theatre companies would look to the other plays, you know, like, you know, The Drums of Father Ned, Cock-a-Doodle Dandy, and, you know, Within the Gates, rather than constantly going back to, you know, to Juno and Shadow of a Gunman and less so Silver Tassie, because it's not done so often, but I suppose the so-called trilogy,
yes.
which are produced a lot.
Yes. As I said, Sean used to say, oh, my God, not Juno again. They want to do Juno again. Yes, what great plays there are there to delve into and to do and to use your imagination with, because they're he went on, and I mean, after the Silver Tassie, they did become smaller in scale. I mean, there weren't 90 actors on stage. And they became, though, full of colour and dance and song and very imaginative, and something that I think I'd love young people to see more of. Figaro in the Night is a great play. And I actually directed his last one, Behind the Green Curtains, up in Derry. And it is a wonderful play, you know, and someone with the right amount of money and time to do that would be very interesting here in Dublin, because it's about people not having the guts to face up to the hierarchy, if you like.
Yes, I think that might be, even now,
a theme. Even now, don't just mean exactly. Dublin, yes, I mean England, no, everywhere, yes, you know.
The world.
The world, yes.
In the world, you know, in that larger international context, is there an abiding interest in Sean O'Casey's work? Do you find theatre groups, international groups, looking to put on productions of the plays and to put on productions in other languages, in
yes.
translated versions?
I just saw not long ago, I went with John Fairley over to Romania, where the huge National Theatre were putting on The End of the Beginning, which has been a phenomenal success, starting off in Germany. Is it Otto Sander, who was in Wings of Desire? He played in it, and it was a huge success because he made it into a evening's performance, because he added all these amazing tricks. And it just took off, and all these companies did it, and finally they did it in Romania, and it was wonderful. They did it on a big stage, a 1,000-seater theatre, brilliant actors, absolutely brilliant. And although they changed the end, which I actually thought would be better not changed, I loved it. It was great. And so that ran for quite a long time. And then in Prague, they keep doing a bedtime story. And before the wall came down, if you like, in Germany, they did all the later work. They did even Behind the Green Curtains. They did, you know, Figaro in the Night, all of them. And then, of course, the Brecht Theatre did Purple Dust, which my mother went to see. That was when she was still alive. So, yes, it is happening all over the world now and again.
Siobhan O'Casey there. And as you heard from Sean O'Casey's own words, the musical landscape of Dublin ran deep in his memory and in his work. The man who gave us the simple beauty of the song Nora also wrote several other striking and original lyrics for theatre songs. Some of these and other texts were given new musical arrangements and settings by Paul Brady on the 1980 album The Green Crow Calls, a musical tribute to Sean O'Casey. The songs on that recording were sung by the actor John Kavanagh, who also spoke texts like The Lament for Thomas Ashe. Kavanagh is no stranger to O'Casey's work. In fact, he's just recorded a new BBC radio drama production of Juno. I spoke to him about the making of The Green Crow Calls all of 34 years ago. What were his memories of it?
I was doing Brian Friel's play Aristocrats in the Abbey, and Eileen O'Casey came to see it one night, and we were talking. And the following year would have been 1980, which was the centenary of Sean's birth, so she wanted to get a record of his songs, songs used in the shows and other songs that were not necessarily in any of his plays, but they're probably mentioned in the autobiographies. She asked me to do it, and I said I would, and we did. And then I went off to the BBC to do Red Roses for Me. So it's a kind of I've had a long association with Sean O'Casey, I must say.
And an extraordinary lineup of people on that album. Paul Brady, Sean Davey, Audrey Parks from the Symphony Orchestra. Yeah. The sound on that is so memorable.
It's beautiful, and beautiful in every way. The artwork on the cover, the sleeve of the LP is beautiful as well.
Making that must have been extraordinary, because some of the songs are so particular, and again, the weaving of music and your voice. I presume that in making it, there's only so much you could sing at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was only about the second LP recorded at Windmill when they opened up first down there in Windmill Lane. U2 may have been the first people to record that. I'm not sure, or maybe they were after we did this thing. But it was very, very early days for the studio, you know, and it was one of the first things that was produced. And like people like, as you mentioned, Audrey Parks and Sean Davey and Paul Brady were just magnificent, and the amount of instruments they could play, you know, that was just enlightening just to watch them work, you know. But also then when Audrey Parks would come in from the Symphony Orchestra from the Radio Centre, the well, I'd have to vacate while they put their tracks down, so I'd walk up and down the keys for a bit, you know, get my thoughts together, come in and then record. Sometimes a verse at a time, because the things were so long, avoid breaths between in the verse, because it's kind of difficult stuff to sing some of it. But it was really enjoyable to do. My only little sadness about the whole thing is because it had spoken pieces on it, it was listed under spoken arts. So you would never find it in the folk sections in the record stores. Which was a shame, and it sold out everywhere when it came out first. But there you go.
Were you familiar with O'Casey's songs before the recording? I mean, obviously, some you would have known from the plays, but
yes.
the broader range of the songs.
Well, the only one I was really really familiar with was Maggie from because it was it's the song "The Plough and the Stars." Jack Clitheroe sings it to, he sings it as Nora. But because that's her name. But apart from that, there were some I'd never. The Girl from the County Kildare, which we recorded but didn't use, and the track wasn't used, and various other things. Since Maggie went away, I'd never heard. And that's, I think, is a beautiful song. In fact, MacDaro Fahata translated into Irish for me one time. It's called Gujo na Keen, the Imodlumsa Road, his Lossa Glain, the Malafi Grain. I mask no horn of me, bwee. On fail a con go hard to spare, I give it an glee. More tom and crawl a peen and graw. Oh, dimmer storm a cree. And on it goes.
Beautiful. I mean, and again, what struck me from the beginning with that album was the strength and the tenderness of those, the lyrics and the music.
I know. He had a wonderful touch. And I think mainly because this is Sean O'Casey's. I mean, some of these are the songs. But there were traditional songs he put his own words to for the plays, naturally, you know. But I think he was a very, very soft-natured man, basically, you know, and then had a great rapport with very emotional subjects, and particularly to do with relation to women, really, you know. I mean, he's just. I think he wrote so well for women.
No more I'll stroll, no more I'll stroll along the boreen, or see the scarlet poppies flame amid the corn green. No more beneath the hedge I'll watch the butterflies at play, for my heart is filled with woe since Maggie went away. The sweet wild rose that loved to see us there and seemed to bid us hope now droops and tells me to despair. The linnet sings his song unheard, perched on a leafy spray. Oh, my heart is filled with woe since Maggie went away. Their happy charm is fled, and now they seem like blossoms strewn above the silent dead. They're symbols now of sorrow deep and life's swift sure decay. Oh, my heart is filled with woe since Maggie went away. With smiling beams, a heart that now can only sigh. Shine on, bright sun, shine on, while I could curse thy proud display. Oh, my heart is filled with woe since Maggie went away.
then welcome grief, then welcome grief, man's warm, true-hearted friend. For though all things befalls, thou still art faithful to the end. And now I'll walk alone with thee till life turns into clay, for my heart is filled with woe, with woe, since Maggie went away.
What have O'Casey's plays meant to you as an actor?
You know, I love them because, well, I had some great experience, like with Juno the Paycock and Don McCann, God rest him. I mean, we did that. I mean, we changed quite a bit. The second act, it needs to be more of a party. It's not really written. There's not a big enough hoolie. So we actually put extra songs in, and Maureen Potter being in it and she being in that line of business. I mean, knew all these songs and put in various ones, you know, and it made it more of a party. Yeah. But I find him very, as Benny Caldwell, God rest him, used to say, he found it so relaxing going to bed at night and reading an O'Casey play or reading anything by O'Casey, and it was just so kind of soothing, and it brought you back to that different world that was Dublin and O'Casey's growing up time, you know.
My skirts are up above me knees, I'm dancing, sir. Be careful, sir, be careful, please. Your eyes are like twin stars of fire advancing, sir. Oh, do be careful. Good sir, you gave me quite a scare. I hope you'll find your hunting fair. Yes, yes, you're bound to find it there. St. Patrick's Day.
John Kavanagh there from the classic album The Green Crow Cause. You're listening to Arts Tonight. More on Sean O'Casey in a moment.
Join me tonight for Leaside Late Date, just after the Book on One on RTE Radio 1. That's your Leaside Late Date with Lillian Smith here on Radio 1.
Planning everything for two, and now that we're through, I just don't know what...
You're listening to Arts Tonight. 50 years after Sean O'Casey's death, we're remembering that remarkable man.
The next snatch of a song is one that my brother Tom customarily sung when he came home from the army on furlough. And there was a little party held in the house, few bottles of lemonade, few sandwiches, some cups of tea, and a great deal of porter and stout. I remember the chorus only, and it goes like this. Side by side in the crimson tide in the days not long ago, on we dashed and our bayonets flashed and we conquered every foe. One by one as the fight was won, I saw my comrades fall, and I was the only one left to answer the last roll call. Tom, as he sung the song in his red coat and in the fancy of his imagination, saw himself in the midst of this great fight and saw his comrades fall around him one by one, and continued to fancy himself as the last survivor. It gave him a great kick to sing the song, and he felt everything that he sang in the deep recesses of his own mind.
Maybe I didn't feel sorry enough for Mrs. Tancred. When her poor son was found, as Johnny's been found now, because he was a diehard. Oh, why didn't I remember then that he wasn't a diehard or a stater, but only a poor dead son? It's well I remember all that she said, and it's my turn to say it now. What was the pain I suffered, Johnny, bringing you into the world to carry you to your cradle, to the pains I'll suffer carrying you out of the world to bring you to your grave? Mother of God, Mother of God, have pity on us all. Blessed Virgin, where were you when me darling son was riddled with bullets? When me darling son was riddled with bullets? Sacred Heart of Jesus, take away our hearts of stone and give us hearts of flesh.
Peg Monaghan there as Juno in Sean O'Casey's Juno and the Peacock, an RTE radio drama production from April 1953. And before that, O'Casey himself in a recording made by Eileen O'Casey late on in his life. In this year of anniversary, the playwright is remembered in an exhibition at Farmley House in Dublin's Phoenix Park, Sean O'Casey, a rebel playwright with a cause. We visited that exhibition and first met Julia Cummins, librarian and curator at Farmley House, who told us about it.
Because we're so fortunate to have the Lennox Robinson archive here, we have some unique letters between himself, O'Casey, and Lennox Robinson relating to the Dublin Trilogy and then later the
controversy
over the Silver Tassie then, and particularly a letter from Shaw, which was written by him in support of the Silver Tassie. And it was quite interesting because Siobhan O'Casey, his daughter, opened the exhibition and she was able to tell us that the reason it's folded is because it was so important to Sean O'Casey and that he'd kept it in his pocket with him all of the time. And later, Eileen O'Casey sold it and it found its way to Farmley here. So it's wonderful to have that personal insight as well.
Have you had many people visiting the exhibition?
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of interest. A lot of people, you know, would be familiar with Sean O'Casey, but I don't think they'd be familiar with his later works or his political interests either. So, you know, yeah, people have been very interested and lots of visitors.
Julia Cummins there. Writer, director, actor and all-round man of letters and theatre, Peter Sheridan, was writer-in-residence at Farmley House when the O'Casey exhibition opened. We visited the exhibition together and looked first at a letter from George Bernard Shaw to Sean O'Casey, a letter that was very dear to O'Casey.
The Shaw letter's over here. It's handwritten in pencil, as you can see, quite faded.
Remarkable.
Remarkable. You can see the folds in the pieces of paper where O'Casey obviously folded it up and put it in his pocket. I'd say he was taking it out for months afterwards, showing people the letter that Shaw had sent him. You know, you can just imagine that being in the back of his pocket.
19th of June, 1928, my dear Sean. What a hell of a play.
Yeah. I mean, Shaw almost feels in this letter like he's on drugs of some kind. I mean, it's just like some of the phrases in it. He says,
I wonder how it will hit the public. Of course, the Abbey should have produced it.
But even this sentence, Vincent, what I see is a deliberately unrealistic, phantasmopoetic first act, intensifying in exactly the same mode into a climax of war imagery in the second, and then two acts of almost unbearable realism, bringing down all the voodoo war poetry with an ironic crash to earth. There is certainly no falling off or loss of grip. The hitting gets harder and harder right through to the end. I mean, phantasmopoetic. I mean, you'd want to be eating some porridge in the morning to come up with that one, wouldn't you?
That's classic Shaw. What a wonderful letter. And how great that it survived and that it's here for people to see.
But then in the middle of the letter, Shaw comes up with an absolutely brilliant perception. He says, "Your moral is always that the Irish ought not to exist. And you are suspected of opining, like Shakespeare, that the human race ought not to exist. unless indeed you like them like that, which you can hardly expect Lady Gregory with her kindness for Kiltartan to do so. I mean, it's just wonderful stuff. You know, referencing Shakespeare and Shakespeare's kind of thing about the human race, would be, we'd be better off without the human race. And O'Casey kind of started suggesting the same thing in The Silver Tassie. I mean, just absolutely quintessential pure Shaw.
A wonderful selection of letters here from O'Casey to Lennox Robinson in the Abbey. First editions of the plays, manuscripts and early editions of the autobiographies. We might go over and look at one of the letters in particular that I know you've read more than once from 1926, O'Casey to Robinson about the Plough and the Stars.
This just absolutely sublime letter from O'Casey criticising the actors in the Plough and the Stars who are making a song and dance about saying certain words and singing certain songs in the show. I mean, it's just absolutely quintessential Sean O'Casey.
This from 1926.
Indignation.
10th of January 26.
Filled with anger. And one of the things that's remarkable about letters of these of this period is, first of all, they'd no Tippex, so you got one chance. It was a one chance saloon. You couldn't correct the stuff, and there are very, very few mistakes in it. But David Crowsey, who of course famously written several books on Sean O'Casey, has actually marked with a light pencil the typos in the letter, of which there are maybe two. But fantastic, wonderful stuff.
I love this. Neither can I see any reason standing beside the objection to such words as snotty, bum, bastard or lousy. To me, it isn't timidity but cowardice that shades itself from them. Mm. And it's full of anger but also full of great wit. I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm not seeing, not even, I'm afraid, a reincarnation.
Yeah.
God forbid.
But he kind of wrote like he was kind of St. Paul writing to the Thessalonians, or he had that whole biblical thing in his letter writing. They're kind of full of these kind of wonderful phrases, far-reaching phrases and sub-clauses, and you can kind of imagine him working up his anger as he puts in another comma to have another go at the other person.
It's just, here's another one from, what year is it? 28, is it again? To Lennox Robinson, but signed in Irish. Sean S. O'Casey, isn't it?
Yeah, and famously, of course, when he wrote his first book, The Story of the Irish Citizens' Army, published in 1919.
Which is here.
With the typo on the front cover, P. O'Casey, of course, and it should have been S. O'Casey. And it's famously, you know it's a first edition when you see the name spelled wrong.
See the P.
But he published this book, he self-published this book with money he received from his mother's debt. So Sean O'Casey's first effort in literature in Ireland, he self-published himself with his own money.
Because he was secretary, wasn't he, of the Citizens Army?
He was secretary of the Citizens Army in 1914, of course, and famously had a huge personality conflict with Countess Markovic. He did not get on with Countess Markovic at all. They hated the sight of each other. And so that didn't make things easy because she was a major player in the Irish Citizens Army, as he was himself. And in fact, it was due to the row with her that he withdrew and got on with the rest of his life.
It's fascinating to look at an early letter like this one from 1922 to Lennox Robinson, where he's saying, I've just completed On the Run. It's a tragedy in two acts. And to see a letter anticipating the work that will come later, you know, and again, I'll bring it over on Tuesday night. Should you not be in the theatre on that night, it should come again on Wednesday. So he wasn't going to give up.
And of course, On the Run became Shadow of a Gunman. Mm. And in fact, when I started to work in the Abbey in the mid-80s, the older actors like Sean O'Brien and people like that would always refer to Shadow of a Gunman as On the Run. We're doing On the Run again. Because in a way, that gave you status. That meant you had a copy of the play before it became the Shadow of a Gunman. So it was like a badge of honour in the Abbey. If you could say, well, my copy of On the Run there is on the table. Would you pick it up and hand it over to me, please?
Some lovely first editions here as well. I mean, the books generally are pretty special, aren't they?
Yeah.
Bishop's Bonfire, lovely edition of it.
And this one here, now this became something else. The Night is Whispering became The Star Turns Red, am I right?
This is a banned play.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the one that caused the controversy at the 1957 or 58 Dublin Theatre Festival.
Yes.
Yeah. the Archbishop of Dublin refused to say the what they call the Toastal Mass for the beginning of the festival because there was a play by O'Casey and a play by Joyce on the programme of the Dublin Theatre Festival. The result of which was that O'Casey withdrew the rights to all of his plays and Beckett withdrew all his. And Beckett didn't give them back until maybe 64 or 65. So it was about a seven-year period there where Samuel Beckett refused to allow his work to be produced in Ireland as a result of this controversy with the Dublin Theatre Festival.
This typed note, great line in what O'Casey typed up, you know, in response to, to that banning of the play.
Yeah.
The drum that became the Drums of Father Ned, but he says that silence, that dreadful bell, it frightens the isle from her propriety. It was silenced. Prelate John Charlie had his way for the time being.
It's wonderful. Great. And prophetic as well, you know.
A beautiful selection of, presume again, first editions of The Star Turns Red, Purple Dust, Red Rose for Me, Oak Leaves and Lavender, and Cockadoodle Dandy. They're wonderful hardback first editions.
Yeah. And in a way, we've sort of moved beyond that a bit too, in that, you know, books don't have the same cachet because we're in a world of, you know, computers and sending things by email and tech, you know, all of this stuff. So, you know, this kind of production of books, I think, is a thing of the past, you know.
So it's beautiful. I mean, they're beautiful objects.
They totally
the red star on the white and the black of the red, the star turns red, the purple cloud and purple dust and the red and red roses. They're so delicate. They're lovely objects apart from anything else. They're really, really beautiful. And more, this display here. I must say it's wonderful to see this exhibition here at Farmley and to see O'Casey remembered and honoured, as was in this place where so many people come to visit and get an insight into Irish life and you wouldn't necessarily expect to encounter O'Casey here, so it's very good to.
No, you wouldn't, but you know, again, it's part of that fascination of, you know, a character like him. I mean, you see, success came to him quite late. He was in his mid-40s when Shadow of a Gunman was first produced. He was still working as a road digger at the time when the play was actually running in the Abbey. He was going to work in the morning digging the road. So here was an example of obviously somebody with you know, very strong working class credentials, somebody without a formal education, never went to university, you know, and yet had this enormous talent, this enormous theatrical talent, waiting to be discovered in a city like Dublin. And it just seems that every generation, Dublin or Ireland, throws up somebody like this. You know, we have this ability as a nation to throw up these extraordinary people who have this extraordinary contribution to make if they're given the platform. And we must keep working at making that happen.
Peter Sheridan there at Farmley House in Dublin's Phoenix Park. That exhibition, Sean O'Casey, a rebel playwright with a cause, continues until October. And Peter Sheridan's own show, Break a Leg, which touches on his family links to Sean O'Casey, runs at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin from the 29th of April to the 10th of May. Now, earlier we mentioned that O'Casey's play The Silver Tassie has just opened at the National Theatre in London. The Guardian theatre critic Michael Billington has seen many productions of that play, famously rejected, of course, by Yeats at the Abbey. He's been talking to me about O'Casey and his work and the continuing relevance of Silver Tassie, a play exploring some of the landscape of the First World War. An experimental play, but one of enduring power.
Well, yes, that is the play's virtue and perhaps its problem, because, of course, that famous second act is an allegorical fable about about the First World War, and it uses Gregorian chant and plain song and heightened poetic speech, etc. And it is a magnificent act, and I know O'Casey himself later referred to it as one of the finest things he'd ever written. But, of course, it sits within a play that has surrounding acts of what you might call Dublin realism. And while the play, I think, is wonderful, I've seen two or three wonderful productions of it, it does create, I think, a technical problem. Do you do it as almost two plays, a realistic play and a symbolic play? Or do you, as a production I saw Lynn Parker do at the Almeida in London in 1995, suggest there is a unity to the play? And what she did, I remember, was to surround the proscenium arch with Goya-esque images of war. So you would never could forget the horror that the play is really about and the destructive effect of war, not only on the people who fight, but on the civilians as well.
Some critics would say that
The Silver Tassie should be read and considered as part of a almost of a quartet of Dublin plays, with Juno, Shadow of a Gunman and The Plough of the Stars, which are generally described as a Dublin trilogy, but and Tassie as a kind of standalone experimental work. Would you agree that this is a useful way of looking at the play, that it's very much linked to the others in its core, while substantially different in style?
I think it's linked to the other plays in one crucial way, and I think it's the key, perhaps, to Casey, that he was always on the side of the people against lofty abstractions. And that comes out in all his great plays, and it comes out in The Silver Tassie. And there's that marvellous resonant line, I think, in the last act, when someone says, "The Lord giveth, but man taketh away." So I think there is a sort of thematic consistency running through all the plays. Having said that, I do think The Silver Tassie doesn't quite belong with the others. And of course, Yeats, in that very famous and hurtful letter of rejection, put his finger on it when he said, "Well, this time you're writing about something outside your own experience, and the play therefore acquires a kind of editorial tone." And although I think Yeats was wrong to reject the play for the Abbey Theatre, and of course it had a terrible effect on O'Casey's later career, at the same time, he does have a point. There is a kind of stylistic oddity about the play. And it's, as I said, it's what makes the play remarkable, but it also makes the play harder to stage, I think, than any of the other O'Cases.
Siobhan O'Casey, we heard say there that her father used to bemoan the endless productions of Juno, and she herself says she'd love to see new productions of plays like Within the Gates and Cockadoodle Dandy or The Drums of Father Ned. Why do you think those plays are so seldom done anymore?
A very good question. I think it's partly because people don't read enough. Literary managers and directors do not explore sufficiently the Irish repertory, or indeed the world repertory. There is a difference of tone, I think, in the later plays, because the poetic symbolism often becomes much more evident. The politics becomes slightly more strident, if you like, in the later plays. And there are sometimes problems in staging them. I remember a wonderful line that Kenneth Tynan used when The Bishop's Bonfire, I think, was a later play, was done at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin and got a raucous reception. Tynan said, "The Irish never forgive those they have insulted." And in a way, because O'Casey went into exile virtually after The Silver Tassie, his later plays have lain fallow, as it were. But I think this just shows how unadventurous our theatres, your theatres, our theatres in England are, that we don't simply read enough. And Within the Gates is a play I have read, and I thought, why isn't this being done on stage? But as you say, we get endless revivals of the acknowledged masterpieces. I think the other thing is that the greatness of those early plays resides in this extraordinary mixture of tragedy and comedy. And that was, I think, O'Casey's specific gift of the theatre. And in the later plays, that there isn't that seamless blend of the high and the low, that almost Shakespearean ability to cross from one mood to another within a second. But I still would love to see the later work done.
I presume you've seen a good many productions of O'Casey plays over the decades, probably of those, the three that are generally done. Are there some productions that stand out particularly in your memory?
Yes, I've seen quite a few Junos over the course of a lifetime. The one I remember most vividly is one that Trevor Nunn did for the Royal Shakespeare Company back in 1980, which had one of the great Irish actors, Norman Rodway, in it as Jack Boyle. And Rodway was wonderful at suggesting the sort of cocky bravura of a man who played the role of some kind of naval, experienced naval figure, and obviously had hardly ever been to sea in his life. John Rogan, another wonderful actor, sly, ingratiating joxer. But the great performance was Judi Dench, actually, as Juno. And I said at the time, an extraordinary mixture of exhaustion and despair. And when her husband started his seafaring nonsense, she would just raise an eyebrow with a shrug of, "Oh, goodness, here we go again." And what she reminded us, of course, was that in O'Casey's plays, it's the women who often bear most. They bear the suffering. They do the work, it seems, while the men talk and idle and booze. And it's the women who actually motor the society. And I thought that came out quite beautifully in that production.
There's also, I think, another production that's quite vivid for you.
Well, yes, in the late 1970s, Bill Bryden did a quite excellent production of The Plough and the Stars at the National Theatre. And one of the glories of that was it allowed British audiences to see Cyril Cusack as Fluter Good. and I said at the time, physically looking more like a walrus than a carpenter, with wonderful drooping moustache and depressed eyebrows and legs that seemed to buckle inside their trousers. But the great thing, again, about that performance was it reminded us that although Fluter is simply a sort of idle drinker, when it comes to the moment, he is actually capable of wonderful acts. And during the play, he arranges for the burial of two children at the expense of his own life. And that was exactly Ocasio's point, it seemed to me. Heroism did not consist in gestures and language and rhetoric. Heroism consisted in human actions.
You've pointed to Ocasio's influence on John Arden, especially in plays like Sergeant Musgrave's Dance and Live Like Pigs. Apart from Arden, do we see his influence on any other writers in post-war British theatre?
It's very hard to pinpoint specific influences. John Arden definitely, because John Arden worked through a kind of rugged prose poetry or poetic prose, whichever word you want to use, that reminded me of a line, I think, of Eric Bentley's. He said that poetry in the theatre should not be something that's vague and gossamer-like, but thick like the rigging of a ship and visible at a distance. And Arden's language had that same texture, solidity, density, richness that Ocasio's did. I would say, generally, Ocasio's desire to say that tragedy and comedy are not pure forms and that life is an admixture of the two. I mean, that has percolated through, I think, through much of late 20th century and early 21st century drama. It's very hard, though, to pinpoint anyone today who does it with the same genius as Ocasio. And what you get, particularly in the younger Irish writers, I'm thinking of people like Martin McDonagh and Conor McPherson, is a lower key sort of tone. And I think possibly I find more evidence of Singh in their work than I do of Ocasio. I think Ocasio was a genius, quite simply, and his influence is there, but it's very hard to point to any specific play that is indebted to him at the moment.
We remembered Brendan Behan on this programme recently, and of course Behan and Ocasio died in the same year, 1964. Ocasio and Behan spoke by phone several times but never actually met. They are linked, though, aren't they, in terms of both theme and style of theatre?
One would love to have eavesdropped on a telephone conversation, wouldn't one, between Behan and Ocasio. My goodness me, that must have been a rich dialogue. But yes, I mean, there is a huge similarity because Behan, like Ocasio, believed in people rather than ideals. He believed in individual urges and needs much more than in abstractions, and particularly nationalist dreams that cost lives. And again, he was very like Ocasio in this extraordinary ability to turn from speech to song, from high art to low art, from high tragedy to low comedy in a second. So yes, I mean, Behan and Ocasio were brothers under the skin. But of course, the difference is Ocasio has this long and extraordinary career, whereas Behan's career is, as we know, short, blighted, brief and glorious.
Guardian theatre critic Michael Billington there. It turns out, incidentally, that Behan spoke to Sean Ocasio by phone a number of times, though they never met. And Siobhan Ocasio told me she sometimes wished they'd lived closer to each other. Perhaps her father, she said, would have been able to help the younger writer. On how best to honour her father's legacy, apart from putting on the plays, Siobhan Ocasio said the best tribute to him would be a country that was fairer and more truthful. We leave you tonight with another song from that wonderful album, The Green Crow Calls, John Kavanagh singing All Round Me Hat. If ever an album deserved to be re-released and properly promoted, played and acknowledged as a great work honouring the songs and legacy of a great man, this is it. This Easter Monday night, we remember Sean Ocasio and all the singers and music makers who tuned the way for him. Till next Monday at 10, good night.
I wear a band of green ribbon, oh, careless of what any lofty mind may say. If anyone should ask me why, I'll tell them e'er I wove it all round me hat, and e'er it's destined for to stay. All that
that she is or was is woven in that ribbon, oh. A chieftain's lying low in Cloyst at Clonmacnoise today. The bugle call of Finn that shook the mountain high, the valley low. Cuchulainn's chariot rush that took the foeman's breath away. All that her saints have done, her sinners gave mortality. The time they stood undaunted up, the time they slipped and fell. The beauty of the old, the books and all the songs her poets sung are woven in this ribbon green and woven fair and well.
Arts Tonight, presented by Vincent Woods, is produced by Aileen O'Mara for Digital Audio Productions. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio player, available online at rte.ie. And Arts Tonight is repeated on Wednesday mornings at 4 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1 through the night. You can podcast the programme as well from our website, rte.ie/radio1/artstonight.